welcome to a special edition of the Boomer Beat. Yes, the Boomer Beat is back. It's a reboot. I know I've been gone a long time, but this is a special occasion, and I wanted to make sure that I hosted this particular segment of the Boomer Beat because of my special guest today. His name is Osha Gray Davidson. Now, you may say, okay, well, what makes him so special? Why do I care? Well, because Osha Gray Davidson is the author of the best-selling book, The Best of Enemies, which was in movie theaters and is in some movie theaters still today. This is a book about the school desegregation of Durham Public Schools. It goes a lot deeper than that, but that's the premise of it, involving a gentleman named C.P. Ellis, who was the grand cyclops of the Ku Klux Klan, and Ann Atwater, who was a very vocal, staunch supporter of civil rights in the Durham area. So once I discovered that we were connected on Twitter, I thought, oh my God, I really need to reach out to him to see if I can do an interview, because there were just a lot of things and questions that I had about him wanting to do this book. So without further ado, let me introduce my guest to you, Osha Gray Davidson. Hey, Osha, how are you?
I'm doing great. It's wonderful to talk with you, and I appreciate your invitation to be on your podcast.
Well, thank you so much. I am very excited that you wanted to do it. I appreciate that. So let's just jump right in and get right down to the nitty-gritty here.
Sounds good.
Okay, so when I was researching your background, I didn't see any connection to North Carolina. Now, I don't know why that was. Maybe some information was left off, but I'm just curious, where did your interest in writing this book come from?
Well, it was really, I mean, it wasn't that, I didn't have any particular connection to North Carolina at the time. This was back in the 80s. And Studs Terkel had written a book called Race. And I was reviewing it for a newspaper. I was and am a freelancer. And there was a small section in there about Ann Atwater and C.P. Ellis. And it was just an amazing story of how, at a surface level, it was an amazing story of how the head of the Klan of Durham, North Carolina, got to be friends with a Black woman, a community organizer in Durham. But the issue of race and class and how those two things are different, but they're linked in America, was what interested me. And the more I looked into the story, the more I developed an interest in it and wanted to write about it, and eventually was able to convince a publisher that this was a story that should be told. And I'm glad I did. And now, you know, many years later, Robin Bissell, the screenwriter director, made it into a movie. So I'm very thankful for that.
Now, in doing your research, did you physically speak with, sit down with C.P. Ellis and Ann Atwater and talk to them?
Oh, yeah. I mean, for a period of years, I would go down there and spend a couple of weeks at a time. And C.P. and I drove, C.P. would drive me around Durham. And we had a lot of conversations, just him pointing out places. He liked to drive also. And he would point out the Klan Hall and just the gas station that he owned and ran, and just different places, and talk about his life and what happened. And then I met Ann, was not in terribly good health at the time. Both of them have passed away, unfortunately. But I needed to just sit with Ann at her house. So I spent a lot of time with her talking, and a lot of other people, virtually everybody who's in the book who was alive at the time, I sat with them and talked with them, because that I think that's the best way to get information. I did a lot of archival research, but, you know, conversation is, there's no way to, there's no substitute for that.
That's correct. There's no, absolutely none at all. So when you, you know, wrote this book, did you, could you see a vision? Did you have a vision of what you would like to happen with this book? Because, you know, I'm an author too. And so every time I write a book, I want it to be a bestseller. I mean, that's just my vision always. Do I think that my books will ever become movies? No, I don't think that far out. But when you finished writing this book, what were your objectives?
Well, really, I didn't think too much in terms of that, other than I would hope it would find an audience. I thought that the history, I learned so much about the history of white supremacy and of race in this country that I hadn't known growing up as a white person in Iowa back in the 60s. You know, we still don't do a very good job of educating young people about race and class in America, but back then it was far, far worse. So I was hoping that the book would help educate people about the history of America when it comes to race, and in particular about the myth of whiteness and what powered white supremacy and still does, unfortunately, to this day, and how C.P. Ellis finally saw through the lies of white supremacy. And once he did, he became an anti-racist and was the elected leader of a black union, primarily black union. So what seemed like an optimistic story in one sense, that white people were not doomed to forever be racist if the head of the Klan could unlearn this myth of white supremacy and thrive in the different kind of life where he realized that white and black people are equal, that race wasn't the foundational fact about who we are.
And what I gathered from the movie was he was ostracized by a lot of white people after he, you know, made that historic vote in favor of, letting the school boards integrate, letting the school districts integrate. Is that what he said to you?
Oh, absolutely. He by standing for the truth, he really gave up everything that he had, which wasn't very much, but it was whatever status he had was within the poor white community, and he gave that up. But as he told me, you know, what are you supposed to do when you see the truth? You can't just pretend you didn't see it. So yeah, he was very lonely because he didn't have any close friends after that. He was ostracized by all the poor whites and the working class whites he had been with. And he tried to get the Klan to change, to become a multiracial organization, that he would join with Ann Atwater and become a community organizer that was based around issues of power, poverty, class. And to him at the time, he just didn't think about race, but he saw the commonality between he and Ann and wanted to fight the same, those same battles anyway.
And that was an aha moment for me in the movie when I kind of saw in his mind, or in the actor's mind portraying C.P. Ellis, that he started thinking about, he really was no better off than Ann Atwater and the other blacks in the community. I mean, he was poor and he was white. They were black and they were poor. And
right. And I think that was the essential meaning, essential important lesson in that movie. There was a great scene in it where this is what happened in real life. It was portrayed well in the movie that she tells CP, you know, you think you're in control? You're not in control of anything. You're poor like me.
Right.
The powers that be despise you just as much as they despise me. And he realized that she was right. And it was, Anne was this huge force of nature in Durham. And one of the things that she did was that she spelled out to him the truth about his life. And it took CP a little while, you know, to put the things together, to put the, connect the dots that she had pointed out, but he did. And without Anne, that never would have happened.
Yeah. And how ironic that some 30, 40 years later, that we are still dealing with many of those same issues. And it really is more about class than race, even though I agree with you that they are linked together. So, all right, so let me ask you this question. As far as the movie, was the movie the way you had hoped it would be, as far as, you know, pulling the content from your book and then portraying it on the big screen? Because I see a lot of movies where I have read the book and I thought, oh, this is so disappointing. I would have used this scene from the book and they didn't. So what was your reaction once you saw the movie?
Well, at the time I first saw it, I was just ecstatic because I saw some of the main messages that I took away from the story reproduced on the screen by two brilliant actors, actually a tremendous cast all around. I was very pleased about it. There's always going to be changes made when a book is adapted into a movie. And it's funny because my book has a lot of history in it. And in a movie, you don't have the luxury of spending hours talking about how we got to this point. It
right.
just has to start where CP and Anne are hating each other and then very quickly move through it. So there's no way to tell that full story in the same way. But on the other hand, it reaches a far larger audience with, I guess the question really is, does it capture the essence of what I saw? And did Robin, the screenwriter director, did he feel the same way about what was important in it? And he did. And he and I had talked for years about this. So I think he did a great job.
And I thought Taraji P. Henson was just, I told my husband, I said, oh my God, her acting range is just beyond incredible. I didn't think anybody could pull it off. I mean, especially her, but she was incredible. I didn't know the other actor as well. I mean, you know, I just didn't know who he was, but he was fabulous too. He made me hate him on screen. So that's how I know that you're a good actor,
right.
when I can look at you and hate you. So,
right. And you know, Anne, she didn't live to see the movie come out, but she was alive when Taraji P. Henson was cast to play her, and Anne was just telling everybody, Cookie's going to be playing me. Cookie's going to be playing me, and referring to Taraji's character on Empire, Cookie, and that's how Anne knew that this was going to work out okay. That this was a woman who was capable of being fierce, and Taraji definitely was capable of doing that.
Right now, some years prior to the movie coming out, Duke University picked this book up as a must read for their college freshmen, I believe. Is that not correct?
That is true, yeah. And so fortunately, Anne was alive for that. And we held a panel discussion together at Duke on this. And yeah, that was quite a time. I was very happy to see that.
Did you get any feedback from any of the students at Duke? Because a lot of those students who go to Duke aren't from the area. So, you know, they're coming into an environment basically isolated from the Durham community because they do have their own little world. But did you get any feedback from them? You know, did they have any aha moments and help them to understand Durham better?
Yeah, that was a gratifying part of this, that students at Durham came up and told Ann and I that they really felt that they understood this community that they had just moved to, because this was freshman students.
Right.
That it helped them to know the history of it, which was particularly gratifying because in the book, there's a large, well, some parts of the book deal with the fact that Duke University was a world apart from the city of Durham. And so it was great to see students realizing that this place, that this environment that they were in, there was a lot going on outside of the campus that they could be a part of, but that they wouldn't, the school itself didn't necessarily make them a part of that back then. And that's changed a lot too. There's a lot more community involvement at Duke now, and that's great to see.
Yes, it is, and I do see that when I'm out and about in the community as well. Okay, so what's new on the horizon for you, Osha?
Well, let's see. The newest thing is, you know, let me mention, I mean, this is related to it. One criticism of both the movie and of the book is that it was centered on the white character. It was another race, a movie about race, but that centered on the white character, like the movie Green Book. And I understand that criticism, and I think generally it's absolutely right for movies in particular. I don't know if this came across fully in the movie because there's less time to develop it, but it's good that the book and the movie focused on the white character, because the movie was about whiteness and our failure, white people's failure to understand that we're part of, and the pernicious forms of racism involved in white privilege. And it was, the movie was about, and the book was about, CP seeing through this mythic view of American history and understanding the truth of white privilege, white supremacy, and turning his back on that and providing an example for white people to become anti-racist. So although movies about race, Hollywood has for too long centered it on white characters. In this case, the movie wasn't about just race. It was primarily about whiteness and white supremacy and the need for white people to overcome that in ourselves. So that was a part of negative reaction to the movie that I really understood. And so what I'm working on now, the way this relates, is that what I'm working on now is I covered the reparations hearing for American descendants of slavery on June 19th in Washington, D.C., H.R. 40, House Resolution 40, which would appoint a committee to study reparations. And so now I'm working on producing a podcast to educate people about reparations and the need for them. And that's a fascinating and, I think, just hugely important topic, that if we're going to make progress in this country on issues of race, there has to be a reckoning, and part of that reckoning is reparations. But it's so poorly understood by white people, well, by a lot of people, whether they're white or black, frankly, but particularly by white people rejecting it, not really understanding the nuances of it and why this debt is owed. So I'm interviewing people like Sandy Darity, the economist at Duke, who's been researching this for decades. And it's a really fascinating project that goes to what I think is one of the most promising pieces of resolution of racial suppression of African Americans.
I always remember growing up that my parents would always say they were waiting on their 40 acres and a mule, and I never really understood it then, right? And
as exactly.
As I got older and became more educated, then I got it. And you're right. Even I, as a journalist, don't understand all the intricacies of the reparations, and I certainly welcome you to bring out this podcast and educate all of us. And you know, Osha, I'll help you promote it. So you just
That's great.
Me know when, and we'll get it rolling on Twitter, definitely on Twitter
That's great.
On Facebook.
But, I appreciate that.
When do you anticipate that this will, the podcast will begin?
Great question. I wish I knew the answer to that. It needs to be in the next few months. Because certainly in this year, in 2019, because they're going to try and move forward with a bill, H.R. 40, which, by the way, is named, from what I've been told, the reason it's called H.R. 40, and it's been around for decades, is because of the 40 acres and a mule that you alluded to.
The
what was promised.
Really?
No. Yes, yes.
Wow.
So they hope to move on the bill in the next session, starting in after January. And so I definitely want the podcast to be available for people who want to learn about why it's necessary, what the debt is that's owed, where the money would come from, who it would go to. And none of these are settled questions yet. But the people who I'm interviewing, I mean, I have no expertise in this. I'm a journalist like you. So I'm interviewing experts who will talk about that. And I covered it, the hearing, like I said, in DC for the Crisis magazine, the magazine of the NAACP. And it was a fascinating afternoon after that. I went to the MLK Memorial down in the National Mall and interviewed tourists there and asked what they thought of reparations, and got a good variety of responses. So it's a topic that I think people are very quick to write off, but I think it provides a measure of hope in a very dark time on helping to resolve some issues in this country that desperately need to be resolved.
I am in 100% agreement with you on that, for sure. All right, okay. So as we wrap this up, I want to ask you this one last question. So, knowing all that you know now, if you knew it back then, is there anything you would have done differently? Would you have not become a journalist, a writer? Would you have taken another professional career path? Would you have lived in a different city? What?
That's a good question, but a hard one to answer. I think I would have started working on racial issues earlier, because I've had to make up for time. That I looked at all sorts of different issues, but as a white person, you know, I just did not see how important that was. And I knew some about the institutional racism in the United States, but nothing like what the reality is that other Americans, Black Americans, had to live with every day. So I think I would have studied that more and focused on that more in my writing rather than writing about all sorts of other things that, though I enjoyed, I think this is, not that I think, I know this is the most important issue that I will ever write on. And so I would have prepared myself better, but I'm working as hard as I can now, spending as much time reading history, talking with the experts, and educating myself, and finding the parts of me that still are problematic, that growing up white in society, we absorb, like with the air, we absorb white supremacist ideology and bias. So it's at the same time educating myself about myself and throwing off pieces of myself that are racist and helping or trying to understand the world as it really is, as CP finally understood. So I guess I would just, long answer to a simple question, but I would do a better job at educating myself earlier.
Thank you for that. Thank you for your honesty. You know, I saw a quote, this has been some time ago, that kind of parallels or correlates with what you said, you know, is white people can benefit from racism, but they don't have to be racist. And I think that's oftentimes what you miss, is that, you know, you can say, oh no, I'm not racist, you know, I love everyone and genuinely love everyone and be caring. But because of your white skin, you can still benefit from racism and not be racist.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, we white people benefit from our white skin, whether we want to or not. It just happens because of institutionalized racism. And as a lot of Black leaders and scholars have pointed out, you don't have to be consciously biased to be supporting a racist, institutional racism in this country. I mean, it isn't a choice between being racist and non-racist for whites. It's a choice between being racist and anti-racist. It's our responsibility, because of white privilege, the privilege that we have, to help tear down racism, tear down the structures of racism that are in every area of American institutional life, the law, the criminal justice system, education, the healthcare. That's our responsibility. And also that's a gift. I don't want to use the wrong word here, so let me think for a second, but that's our path to redemption and personal becoming fully human, is to join the battle against racism, to become anti-racist. That's really the only way to come fully alive. And that's what C.P. Ellis realized with the help of Ann Atwater.
Wow. And on that note, I am going to have to end it here, although I just thought of another question I wanted to ask you. So perhaps when you start this podcast, you can come back on my podcast and we can talk a bit more about it, and then I'll remember the question I needed to ask you. But on that note, I am going to have to say thank you so very much, Osha Gray Davidson, for your time and your thought-provoking responses to my questions, and just for this beautiful book that you've written that should be, you know what, I really do think this book should be a part of every English class, high school or middle school, in America. That's what I believe. So thank you for, you know, your consciousness and raising the level of consciousness of all of us.
Well, thank you very much for having me as a guest. I appreciate it so much.
You are very welcome. All right, folks, that's going to do it for this edition, a special edition of The Boomer Beat with your host, Beverly Mahone, and my very special guest today, Osha Gray Davidson. Until next time, remember this. You have gifts to give the world. So find your voice and prosper. See ya.